Scott Pruitt is out as administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, but will his replacement be any different?
There's the thought that he's very skeptical on the idea of EPA regulating greenhouse gas emissions.
So things will be pretty much the same. I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, a look at the former coal lobbyist heading up EPA, at least for now. And the spotted lanternfly could wreak havoc on maple trees and grape harvests. Plus, it's just gross.
It's going to have a big impact. And if we had the adults right now feeding on these trees, it would literally be raining excrement on you. And we would leave here a sticky mess.
And speaking of mess, we visit a summertime celebration where you can really relax and feel the earth between your toes.
I'm super muddy. Really happy.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. A State College-based fracking company paid a total of $159,000 to settle water contamination claims brought by a group of Butler County families. Rex Energy revealed the settlements in recent bankruptcy filings. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports.
In 2011, several families in the Woodlands, a section of Conoquinessing Township, stopped using their well water. They said the water had turned brown and started smelling foul. Some said it made them sick. Many blamed Rex Energy, which had drilled several natural gas wells nearby. But the Department of Environmental Protection and the EPA both looked at water tests and concluded that Rex was not at fault. But the families still complained. Some have had to purchase their drinking water or get it donated from a local church. Several families sued the company, and in April, the company paid the families between $11,000 and $27,000. John Stoltz, a Duquesne University biologist, found 50 families had, quote, significant changes either in water quality or quantity since drilling began in the Woodlands. He was retained by the families that sued Rex as an expert witness, but the case never went to court. He said the water in the Woodlands is still bad.
It hasn't changed. So they're still dependent on the volunteer water drive. The other families that weren't part of the case, of course, didn't get any compensation whatsoever.
Stoltz said the settlement would help those who received it, but doesn't pay for a permanent solution. He estimated a publicly owned water line would cost $1 million to install there.
The fact of the matter is it's that they still don't have water, and the real issue hasn't been resolved yet.
In a statement, the company declined to comment on the settlement and denied wrongdoing. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Pittsburgh is chock full of historic buildings and monuments, but there's a move to get recognition for more of its green spaces, too. The city's Schenley Park has been listed on the National Register of Historic Places since 1985. Now the group Preservation Pittsburgh, along with the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy and the city, are trying to get three more large historic parks listed by 2020. Matthew Falcone is the president of Preservation Pittsburgh. He and I sat on a bench under a tree in Highland Park recently to talk about the initiative.
Preservation Pittsburgh's website says, "Preserving a world made of steel, made of stone," which I happen to know is a line from the song "What a Feeling" from Flashdance, which is set in Pittsburgh. But how do parks fit into your mission?
I would say our mission is not preserving a world of steel made of stone. It's just a bit of a tagline, if you will. But it's about the creation of space and the history that they embody. And so for us, we look at parks the same way that we do at buildings and structures like bridges. What story do they tell? And how does that story fit into the larger narrative of who we are as Pittsburghers? And to understand how their landscape, you know, fits into like larger landscape design in Pittsburgh and the state and the country.
So what story does this park tell?
Highland Park? So, Highland Park.
Short story.
Okay, short story. Highland Park is partly exceptional because it had its kind of inspiration, its dawn with Bigelow. Edward Bigelow was the director of public works in Pittsburgh. He was active at the turn of the 19th and 20th century, and it was kind of his vision that Pittsburgh would have not only a system of parks, but a way that they could be accessed together. And so the boulevard that starts downtown and then leads to Schenley Park. The idea there was there would be a bit of a circuit around the city, and Pittsburghers could go and visit all of these different parks that we had that largely had grown kind of independently.
Yeah, Bigelow Boulevard is kind of a main thoroughfare through the city of Pittsburgh.
And it goes from downtown to a park. I think when we think of roadways, it's, you know, how can we get from our home to work? And in this case, it was, how can we get from the city to green space? And so Highland Park has that kind of special thread of the narrative that ties directly to Bigelow. It also has another exceptional thread that ties directly to our water system. Highland Park exists in part because of the reservoirs that are here.
We're actually sitting right in front of a large reservoir of water that is being held for public drinking water.
Exactly. And so we have a park that exists basically around a very essential municipal function. And there's also other features that contribute to the park's history, kind of down the way, Carnegie Lake. It was originally a middle pumping ground to take water in from, I believe, from the river, and then bring it kind of halfway up and then fill up Carnegie Lake, which at that time encompassed also the swimming pool area and the volleyball courts. And then the idea was then to, like, move the water even further up into a filtration and pumping system. And it didn't come into fruition because there were other advances in water technology. And so then instead of focusing on that area, it became more about the larger reservoirs that are behind us. But you still have this kind of relic that people look at today and they're like, wow, that's a lot of concrete. And Carnegie Lake has changed over time. It's more recreational. And even now, like, there's a movement to reintroduce fish to the lake and to make it more of a natural environment that people can enjoy. And something like that, it's that wonderful synthesis of what was and what is and what do we need.
Is this initiative unusual because it's parks?
Yeah, I think so. I think when people think about preservation and when they think about what that is and what that means, it usually centers on old historic buildings. Preservation has its roots in conservation and the founding of our national park system in the early 20th century. And so it's a little unusual because of how people perceive preservation, but from our perspective, they go hand in hand.
Yeah, say a little bit more about that.
I think what ties them together, especially with the case of our parks, is their root, that these are spaces that have been specifically set aside and set aside for, in some cases, over 100 years as space that is accessible and available to all Pittsburghers. It's very kind of democratic in nature. As a collective, when we look at all the parks, each different iteration of the park is in some way a reflection of how people interacted with green space. When we look to, like, Allegheny Commons, it was just a giant mud pit, you know, at the time it was created. But the idea was that there was communal space for everyone. And the park eventually evolved into kind of the very manicured Victorian design that we have today. And then you fast forward to, let's say, the creation of Frick Park. And then the impetus there was really not to create manicured space, but to set aside wilderness in the middle of a dense urban environment. And it's fascinating to think that in a span of 1-2 generations, there was that evolution and how we interact with green space. And then the evolution of Frick Park is equally as interesting. To us, it's not just about landscape. It's about the role that Helen Frick played in creating the park itself. It originally started out as a much smaller park. And as kind of years progressed, she was responsible for expanding the park through acquiring basically different country clubs that were in the area. And so when we go to Frick Park today, there's all of these different landscapes, like these rolling grassy knolls. And those actually correspond to the park's additions of these country clubs. It's interesting to think of those exact kind of, not diametrically opposed, but different ideas of what green space can be. And so Frick Park has a very kind of interesting evolution. And also, I would say, I'm very proud that both Frick Park and Schenley Park directly relate back to women's contributions to our city and to our environment. Mary Schenley is responsible for gifting the city Schenley Park, and Helen K. Frick is responsible for giving us Frick Park.
They were both heiresses of prominent Pittsburgh families that made their money in all of the industry that was in Pittsburgh.
Exactly. And when you think about, you know, the role that women played in society at that time, it's exceptional. And I think that, you know, that narrative needs to be acknowledged just as much as Bigelow's narrative does.
Matthew Falcone is the president of Preservation Pittsburgh. There's more about their effort to get Pittsburgh parks listed on the National Register of Historic Places at AlleghenyFront.org. You're listening to The Allegheny Front. I'm Kara Holsapple. International trade brings us fruits and vegetables, computers and cars. But here's another thing it brings to us: invasive species. Pennsylvania is now a battleground for the latest invader, known as the spotted lanternfly. It hitched a ride here from Asia. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports on the rush to keep the pest from migrating to other parts of the country.
The Port of Philadelphia's inspection station is a giant warehouse that smells, surprisingly, of pineapples. Workers unload large tractor trailers carrying boxes of potato chips, barrels of honey, and pallets of tires. Armed customs officials lead drug-sniffing dogs around these imports. Logan Alcala looks through boxes of Central American plantains, carefully examining each one, not for cocaine, but for bugs and seeds.
Not a lot of people are willing to be on their knees all day, but once you find those bugs, it's kind of like a little addiction, because it's just so satisfying.
Armed with a biology degree and a flashlight, Alcala works for U.S. Customs and Border Protection. She spots a spider and a seed.
You can see it pops out with the flashlight right here.
Oh, yeah.
Alcala and her colleagues are the first line of defense against invasive species. And last year, her team found 475 potentially harmful bugs and seeds coming in through the Port of Philadelphia.
One of my favorite things is looking at wood pallets, trying to get the Asian gypsy moth, or like you mentioned, the lantern fly.
The spotted lantern fly most likely arrived from Asia on a boat or a plane carrying imported goods. First discovered in Berks County in 2014, it has spread across 13 counties in Pennsylvania, munching on maple trees, grapes, and fruit trees. And the worst thing is, it's not very tasty. So it has no known predators.
There are no birds coming and picking the nymphs off the trees.
David Parr first saw the brightly colored red and black moth-like insect while grilling on his deck in Montgomery County in the spring of 2015.
And I looked up and I saw an adult and said, oh my word, this is the spotted lanternfly. Kids, come take a look at it, because I trapped it and I put it in a jar and said, this is what we need to be on the lookout for.
Parr is an arborist trained to spot pests.
And they said, oh yeah, Dad, we know. They're all over our trees. I said, what do you mean? They're all over our trees. And sure enough, I go out and look. Yeah, they've been knocking them off and playing with them and whacking them with wall bats.
Parr began getting calls from homeowners about a year ago, desperate to save their trees from the pests. Today he's working at a home in Collegeville, Montgomery County, which has maples and willows infested with lanternfly nymphs. Right now they look like a black beetle with white spots. He inspects a silver maple he's been treating.
So these are all the dead guys. If you look by my left hand here, here's a little bit bigger one.
Oh, wow.
And you can see he's a little bit bigger. I would say that this is a...
The lanternfly is known as a plant hopper. They hop around and suck sap from just about anything. Trees, shrubs, herbs. So they could do a lot of damage to crops. Later in the summer, the nymphs develop brightly colored red underwings with black spots. Parr tries to kill them before they get to that stage.
So I'm going to need a hand here.
Okay.
So if you wouldn't mind. So what I need you to do is just hold that here.
He wraps the tree with a band of sticky plastic designed to trap the nymphs.
Hold that there, maybe even up here. Hold it up here.
They're easy to kill with pesticides, but those chemicals will also kill all the good bugs, so he tries to avoid that.
So I'll cut it right here.
A big challenge is that the flying adult insects will lay their eggs on everything. Furniture, rocks, toys, cars, which can then transport them across the country.
If you look up on our side of the picnic tables and the benches, you're going to find eggs. So you just...
Now, that's one right there on the chair.
Yep, there's one right there on the chair.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture just released $17.5 million to fight the lanternfly in southeastern Pennsylvania. Research money is pouring into universities like Penn State and Temple. And the USDA has sent scientists to China and South Korea. Fred Strathmeyer is a deputy secretary at Pennsylvania's Department of Agriculture.
Specifically, the Pennsylvania, we estimate somewhere between, you know, $18 and $20 billion of industry could be affected, and that number could rise.
The federal government is also rushing to hire people who will fan out across the edges of the current infestation to track and kill the bug. Officials in New York are stopping and inspecting trucks at the Pennsylvania border. They fear the bug's impact on grapes and the wine industry.
You can only imagine if spotted lanternfly were to end up in the Napa Valley, for instance. Not be a good moment.
In addition to weakening trees by feeding on them, the adult lanternflies do even more damage. And it's gross. They excrete a sticky sweet substance called honeydew after they eat, which covers leaves and bark. Then that attracts black sooty mold, which grows on the tree, preventing photosynthesis. Parr says the honeydew and the slippery black mold have ended up all over decks and swing sets in the suburbs.
It's going to have a big impact. And if we had the adults right now feeding on these trees, on a willow tree in particular, it would literally be raining excrement on you. And we would leave here a sticky mess.
The irony is the lanternflies love to feast on an invasive plant species, the ailanthus tree, which came to the U.S. from China more than 200 years ago. The ailanthus tree, or tree of heaven, is now a ubiquitous urban weed tree.
Just think of all the ailanthus trees in Philadelphia. They line all the backs of the properties. Underneath all those trees, if you go look there now, and if not now, this time next year, everything underneath those trees is going to be black. Much like sooty mold in the city, right? You know, just particulate matter and air pollution. But this is going to be black from insect poop.
State and federal officials are optimistic they can at least contain it. But Parr says killing the lanternfly, just like the invasive emerald ash borer and the stink bugs that have come before it, will continue to be a big part of his business.
I feel it's spreading faster than what we can get under control. I can guarantee by the time the adults come out, I would look at the Finger Lake region of New York. I would look at the Baltimore region of Maryland and Washington, D.C. for it to be there.
And in fact, this spring, a thriving population of spotted lanternflies were discovered in Virginia for the first time. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Parenting is hard, but International Mud Day can make it easier and more fun for everyone.
I tell the kids that they either have to get covered in mud or have to wear sunscreen, and so we all choose to get covered in mud.
Later on the Allegheny Front, mud. It brings families together, and it's one way to cool down on a hot summer day. We'll wade into that later. Stay tuned. It was the day many environmentalists were waiting for, Friday, July 6th. That's when Scott Pruitt stepped down as administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. Pruitt was embroiled in a number of scandals involving extravagant spending and the use of his office to benefit family members. In the end, the news Pruitt was generating proved too embarrassing for the Trump administration and overshadowed his role as President Trump's champion of deregulation. So who is stepping into that role? Well, for now, it's Andrew Wheeler, who was deputy administrator at EPA. To learn more about him and what the change means, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier spoke with Zach Coleman, a reporter with E&E News, for our podcast, Trump on Earth.
So what do we know about Andrew Wheeler? I mean, famously, by now, a lot of people know he was a coal industry lobbyist. He used to work for an Oklahoma senator named James Inhofe. What can you tell me about him?
He has a long history on Capitol Hill, a long history as a lobbyist. He is definitely conservative. He definitely doesn't love the idea of regulating energy companies, but he is someone who has worked with Democrats from his time on Capitol Hill. He's someone who worked at EPA under George H.W. Bush, which many career staffers sort of consider the golden years of the EPA when, you know, there was broad agreement on environmental protection and they were sort of left alone by a Republican president. And he is going to have more buy-in from his staff just because he's been in those offices before. He's collegial. But at the same time, he's not going to have any sort of departure from what Scott Pruitt was doing in terms of policy. But from the career staffers that I talked to at EPA, it's sort of about having the right mindset, a good governance mindset. You can eventually bring the staff along to do the work that the whatever administration wants to do. And Andrew Wheeler has the disposition to get people to work towards those goals.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the sort of a comparison has been made that Wheeler doesn't really defer from Pruitt's general philosophy, but, whereas Pruitt might have been mired in these kind of bizarre, you know, own goal kind of scandals where he just basically flouts the basic rules of government ethics, Wheeler's like, he keeps his head down, you know, he keeps his nose to the grindstone and he just grinds away at the, you know, whatever the work is, that maybe he'll be even more effective than Pruitt was.
Yeah, and that's the thing that we've heard from industry. They didn't want to say it while Scott Pruitt was still there, but I think everybody recognizes that Andrew Wheeler is steeped in environmental policy. That's what his whole career has been in. Scott Pruitt sued EPA 14 times, but he was a career politician. He was an attorney general. He doesn't come from the same background. So there's this thought that Andrew Wheeler, he knows all the players. He's a creature of Washington. He knows the policy. He can get this stuff done. And for environmentalists, that scares them a little bit because he's not going to be as flashy. It might be a little bit harder to attract attention to the EPA without the bizarre scandals and headlines that Scott Pruitt was, you know, creating and turning into material for Stephen Colbert and Trevor Noah and everyone on the late night circuit.
So before he became a lobbyist, Wheeler worked for Senator Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma, and he was one of the more outspoken climate deniers in the Congress. So climate change is an important, it's sort of, the environmental issue of our time. What do we know about where Wheeler is on climate change?
There's the thought that he's very skeptical on the idea of EPA regulating greenhouse gas emissions. And there had been on his lobbyist profile at his old firm some comments that alluded to the endangerment finding, which is basically the legal underpinning that says greenhouse gas emissions harm the public health and therefore have compelled EPA regulation of greenhouse gas emissions. He casts doubt on whether that is a solid finding. That has since been scrubbed from his lobbyist profile, so you can't find that. There's this thought that he is just as opposed to regulating and acknowledging the role that humans play on warming the planet. So I don't think that you were going to see this administration do much on greenhouse gas emissions in general, but the fact that Andrew Wheeler is there largely in the same mold as a Scott Pruitt pretty much affirms that nothing's going to happen on that front.
Zach Coleman is a reporter with E&E News, and he spoke with the Allegheny Friends Reed Frazier for our podcast, Trump on Earth. There's more about Scott Pruitt's resignation and Andrew Wheeler at TrumpOnEarth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And check out the very latest episode of Trump on Earth. It's about Trump's pick for the Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh, and what his appointment could mean for environmental cases coming before the court.
He has issued a number of decisions that really constrain EPA's ability to regulate greenhouse gases.
That's at TrumpOnEarth.org. Research shows getting dirty can be good for you. Dirt contains a microscopic bacteria which can boost the immune system and even your mood. Maybe that's why International Mud Day is so much fun. It began in 2008 with the World Forum Foundation as a way to connect kids with nature and the earth. Our producer Andy Kubis recently traveled to the Ithaca Children's Garden to check out the muddy festivities there.
Mud Day! Mud Day.
Mud Day.
Mud Day. Mom, it's slippery. Stop.
My name is Erin Martiel, and I'm the executive director of the Ithaca Children's Garden.
we are hosting our 6th annual International Mud Day.
There are slides with mud on it.
Sliding like a penguin into the mud.
This is perfect because the mud is so nice and cool.
International Mud Day was started in Nepal and Australia as a time to celebrate the end of the monsoon season and the beginning of the rice planting season. And then it morphed from there into just a joyful celebration of the great outdoors and crossing through barriers of getting dirty.
I'm super muddy, really happy.
And I love Jordy, and it was so awesome. I can't believe it. It's so muddy.
And it's nice and cool because it's a very hot day.
International Mud Day is primarily focused in the Hands on Nature Anarchy Zone, which is filled with a ton of mud, literally a ton of soil that then the fire department comes and hoses down and turns into mud. And people have started sifting into the mud pit. And what we'll see over the course of the day is kids and adults experimenting with their own comfort level. So some people show up and they dive right in. Other people show up and might tiptoe around the edge and might just leave with a single handprint on their t-shirt.
I like the way at the bottom of the mud pools, there's like a bunch of like half mud and half water, so like it creeps around your legs. It's like it feels like seaweed in the ocean. It's usually really dirty, but luckily there's no worms in this mud, so your feet can go safely in without stepping on any worms.
Mud Day is really a time to face some of the fears around getting dirty and just really embrace with all of our senses the beauty that makes up the earth, which has a lot to do with the soil and the mud.
I'm covered in mud, and I tell the kids that they either have to get covered in mud or have to wear sunscreen, and so we all choose to get covered in mud.
What do you like about mud, Ethan?
That is yucky.
Yes, very fun.
Very, very fun.
It feels good since there's a heat wave.
Mud is part of the earth. It's part of the soil. It is a very sensual sensory experience for all of us, but especially for young children. And so to be able to get our toes into the mud, our hands into the mud, and use it to create artwork, to create mud muffins, mud cakes.
I make a cake. Make a cake.
What kind of cake?
Chocolate cake.
There's mud ice cream with worms in it.
Oh my gosh, worms in it?
Yeah.
Since we started holding Mud Day, we've had a number of communities from across the U.S. reach out to us to ask what it takes to hold their own Mud Day. It's just a fun event that connects people outside to the living world.
Look out back to the mud pit!
Andy Cubis produced that story, and you can see her photos from Mud Day, read more about its history, and get the dirt on why playing in mud might be good for us at AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. Hey, if you decide you're going to go out and play in the mud, take a photo and tweet it to us, at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.